started here this morning and property center fellas about continuous time Monte Carlo, and we're finally going to hear about what the phonons do in strongly coupled systems.
Wow, you're very optimistic, but you have high expectations. Yeah, that's not good. So thank you very much, Doug, for the organization and for allowing me to be here. So the idea here is basically a conceptual question: what methods, Monte Carlo methods, do we have to include electron phonon interactions in models of Carlet electrons? So it's more a method that I would like to present, and it's rather new, so we don't have so many applications up till now. So it turns out that there is a novel set of Monte Carlo algorithms which go under the word continuous time quantum Monte Carlo algorithms, which I will review in this first part of the talk, and which are very efficient and very simple and allow you to do many more things which you could not do, in my opinion, so easily within the Hirsch-Phi or within the other types of Monte Carlo methods. And one of them is to include retarded interactions, or in other words, phonon degrees of freedom, or just the general question of how do you put in retarded interactions in a Monte Carlo method. So one application which I will show in quite some detail is the first one we have for the moment is the application to the Korteweg-Hallstein model, and I will show you that you can get quite detailed information on this model by using this method. So I will claim that the method works and has some potential, and at the end I will conclude. So this work has been done with a student of mine, Thomas Lang, and some of the results I'll present here have been published in those two papers. And don't hesitate to interrupt. I go too fast or something's not okay. So let me start with a method and start with the single impurity Anderson model, which I will write with this in this action form. So this is the Bath-Greene's function, if you want, and this is the Hubbard interaction. So how does the method work? Well, it's just based on a weak coupling expansion around the U equals zero limit. So we learn in quantum mechanics one, if you follow my quantum mechanics one in Würzburg, that the partition function, they don't like me, the students, I don't know. Because I do path integrals and everything in quantum mechanics one, and they don't like it, but I like it. So the ratio between two partition functions, we can write it just like this, right? Just the expansion in U. And then what we have to do, and that's the trick here, is to evaluate this expectation value with respect to the non-interacting partition functions for each value of n. So we know that in the first order, we just have this diagram. So this is the Hubbard interactions, an up and a down Green's function. The Green's functions here are defined in this non-orthodox way, like this. And so this can be written as a determinant of a 2x2 matrix, which is diagonal in the spin, and the entries here are those non-interactive Green's functions. And you can go on. So the next order, in the next order, you have four diagrams. So you will count the connected and disconnected diagrams, and you can compactly write all those, the sum of these diagrams, into again a determinant. The entries are the non-interacting Green's functions. It's block. It's a 4x4 matrix, which for this case is block diagonal in the spins, and where the entries are just the Green's functions between those two times tau 1 and tau 2. And you can go on and on and on. So you can, in principle, evaluate each order here at the expense of a determinant. Okay? So that's it. The algorithm, basically, the idea of the algorithm is now set. We have the partition, the ratio of those two partition functions is just a sum. So sum over all orders, an integral over all the times, imaginary times, tau 1 to tau n. So this will define our configuration space in the Monte Carlo. And for each configuration in this space, then we have what we will hope to be a weight, which we know since yesterday that it's not a weight in general. This is a weight, and we will want to sample those produce a Markov process in this space. So of course, that's very nice, but it's not as easy as it is, and this is becoming a bit technical, but I have to go through it. So what about, is that positive or not? And in general, it's not. But it's not worse. What I'd like to say is that it's not worse than other methods, right? So we're just as bad. The method is just as bad or just as good as other methods we know. And you can do this. I won't go through too much of those details here, but basically you can rewrite your Hubbard interaction in this way by summing over an Ising spin plus or minus 1 and shifting the up and the down. So if you carry out the sum over the spins, you won't change anything up to a constant. And you can rewrite this as what we know more or less from a Hubbard discrete Hubbard-Chatanovich decompositions. So in this way, you have two parameters, delta and k here, which are related by these equations. And you see that delta has to be bigger than 1/2. And that gives you a mapping. This equation here gives you a mapping between two algorithms, this continuous time Monte Carlo algorithm and a much older algorithm, which was found in 99 by Stéphane Hombou and was discussed again by Emmanuel Gould last year. And this is the continuous time Hirsch-Phi algorithm. And this mapping was done by a student in Mark Jarrell's group. So what we learned from this is that the sine problem you have here is the same sine problem as you have in the continuous time Hirsch-Phi method. And we also know that the continuous time Hirsch-Phi method behaves very much sine-wise as the Hirsch-Phi method. So we have here a method, if you want to tell you, you know how to treat the sine problem in the Hirsch-Phi, then you should also be able to treat the sine problem here. If you can't do it in the Hirsch-Phi, you won't do it here. So the two methods, sine-wise, are equivalent. Okay, so there is no, okay, so that's for the sine. There is also no reason to have this, in this method here, you're much more flexible in how you want to get rid of the sine problem in some very specific cases. You don't have to introduce the stochastic field, although we do in general. You could just have a static shifting, if you want, of this Hubbard term, and you have to break, here you break the SU2 symmetry, and you would have to absorb this breaking of the SU2 symmetry in the non-interacting part. And also, there is one special point, delta equals zero, the particle hole symmetry case, when you can put delta equals zero and avoid the sine problem because of the same reason as you can do that in the determinantal Monte Carlo.
Kind of historical interest. Yeah. I mean, it's a kind of a natural thing to do, right?
What?
Just some diagrams by the computer, in essence.
Yeah.
When did it really start? I mean, does it have a very long history? Or
I think the diagrams were, I think the first thing I read was from Nikolai Prokofiev, this Polaroid.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
So, but it's a bit different because what Nikolai does is really to sample each diagram.
Yeah.
Right? So you can do many things in his method, which we can't do here. Here you're just stuck with classes of diagrams. I can't pick up one diagram and do it here, right? So this representation is summing up classes of diagrams and not one diagram at a time, which was Prokofiev was doing, I think, for the Polaron problem. That was back in 80, 85, 89, 90s. Okay, so so now that we've got very quickly, much more quickly, quicker than what Jan was doing yesterday, got rid of the sine problem because we didn't solve it, right? that's the point. Then, how do we do this Monte Carlo? Well, so this is my configuration space. I've added in those stochastic S spin variables, Ising variables, and now the weight is explicitly dependent on those spin variables. And, well, a configuration C is a set of vertices, so I have n tau points and n Ising spins, and I have to move in this configuration space by or adding a vertex or removing a vertex, and these are basically the moves which will suffice to be ergodic, and that's also the ones we have. Measurements, so let me go very quickly through this. If you know how to, for each configuration, you can define a Green's function for this configuration, which is defined like this, and which you can calculate from this equation. So you just, this is the bare Green's function, this is the inverse of this matrix, which is here, so this is what you have to keep in the simulation. And well, since it's a weak coupling expansion around a Gaussian point, you have a Vick's theorem, and then if you know this, then you know everything. You can just calculate all the correlation functions, two particle or three particle as you want, correlation functions. There's one thing which is very nice in this method is that you can directly calculate things on the Matsubara time axis, which simplifies a lot when you're trying to do use this method for DMFT or CDMFT or generally cluster methods. So that's all I want to say. So
you still have to do the Vick rotation to real time, right?
This is a, of course. that you're done. There are some applications, and we're working on this also, of defining this algorithm on the Caldish contour. And so you could do real-time expansion, but there it just started this year, so it's not clear how far we can get and for which type of model.
Let's converge much more broadly than one of the Caldish contour.
Yeah. Of course. But there is some. So the only way out of getting rid of this Vic rotation is going to real time, right? And real time is really tough. You agree? No, but the DMRT people manage. But what the cars?
Can I ask a question? It's called continuous time, but here you treat really the time as continuous, or you discretize also the time?
Yeah. So we of course discretize the time, but we don't pay for it. Right, so we can, we do discretize the time, but it's so small that you don't really care about it. But there is a discretization. So it's continuous in the sense that we can, I can discretize it, find a factor two finer without paying anything. So it's free, so it's continuous. So why is it such a nice algorithm? Why did we start? Why was I persuaded, at least? And this is this equation. What is the average expansion order parameter? So this average n, which comes into here, and you can work out that this is basically proportional to beta times u times the double occupancy, and there are some important factors. So of course, we're playing with matrices which are of this order. That means that the upgrading, et cetera, for one sweep, if you want, is of the order n to the cube. So we get the same scaling as the Hirsch-Phi. There's a prefactor which makes it more efficient. And also there's one point which is just remarkable, is a particle hole symmetric point where you can put delta equals zero without inserting a sign problem, and then n is minimal here, and the program is just amazingly quick. So this is the histogram of the expansion order parameter for a given simulation, and if you get this, then everything works fine. If you don't, then you have
to. The statement somehow is that the temperature and you're at,
right.
You only have to go out so far before
exactly.
You have control
right.
Of your expansion.
Right. So these are some initial runs. This is half filling, beta t equals 400, and this is the single particle Green's function. You see that you can control it over six orders of magnitude. It's amazing. And then, so it really works very well. And I did never try to do this simulation with a Hirsch-Phi because it would have blown up my computer budget. So away from particle hole symmetry, the speed up is not as impressive, but it still works very nicely. There are two curves here, the Hirsch-Phi curve with a finite delta tau and this continuous time curve, and it's okay. This is also a result where you can really calculate that, just to show that we really have the Green's functions and imagine for the Matsubara on the Matsubara axis. Okay, so this is this. So it's a nice method, and I think it's even nicer because it's flexible. And this brings me to the next point, and it's how to implement those phonon degrees of freedom into this method. And before going on into this, let me tell you that Philip Verner and Andy Millis have done this also in a different variant of this method, which is a strong coupling expansion, so an expansion into hybridization, right? So this method they use is a method which is limited to very small clusters. The method here, this weak coupling method, is a method which you can go to larger clusters.
Then Millis is also a quantum Monte Carlo.
Yes, it's also a quantum Monte Carlo. Right, just instead of expanding in U, you expand in the hybridization. So you expand around a strong coupling point. So how do we propose to do this? So let us start with a Hubbard-Hollstein model, which is here. So these are the phonons. And so what we can do is integrate out the phonons. If we integrate out the phonons, we have this action. This is the bare action for this term. This is the Hubbard term. And then this is just a Gaussian integral. You just integrate out those phonons. And what you obtain is an attractive, so there's that here, plus in this notation is an attractive, and density-density interaction between different points in space and time. So it's a retarded interaction. You can work out. D naught is just the propagator of the phonons. If you have Hollstein phonons, this is diagonal in space and has this time dependence. This time dependence is just time scale, which is set by 1 over the phonon frequency, which is given by this. Right? So, and then you can recover, of course, in the anti-adiabatic limit, you will recover the attractive Hubbard model with a U, which is given by G squared over 2K. Right? So
you don't pay a big price when you go to non-local electron-poly interactions, meaning I and J and all the same.
You don't pay a price at all.
Yeah.
We didn't do it because we tried to do some things in DMFT, and then in DMFT, it's hard if you have something which is non-local. But if you stay on a lattice, there's no problem. Right? This is a point we haven't done yet. We want to do SSH phone, different phone nodes. This has to be done. But we haven't played it. So once you have this action, you can, instead of expanding, we can expand it. What we did before is just expand in the Hubbard view. You can just expand in the Hubbard view, and also in this retarded interactions, you have different vertices. But in principle, the idea of the method remains the same. So the vertices now we have was this Hubbard vertice, which is equal in time between spin up and spin down. And now to this vertex, which we have to deal with, we have to add those three other vertices. So this is between two spin degrees of freedom. It's non-local in time and space. This is between down-down, and this is between up-up. So the program becomes a bit more complicated, but the idea, the concept becomes exactly the same. Right? You just sum up different vertices. You just generalize, if you want, the concept of this vertex. And then you have a program which can treat phone nodes. So that's why I started, because you could not work so much and get a program which has maybe potential. I mean, an algorithm which has some potential. So I'd like to show you that it does work for, unfortunately, now still a very simple-minded problem, which is the half-filled, the quarter-filled Hallstein model, which turns out to be actually pretty rich. So this is, I'd like to go through some data now, and I'll stop in exactly 20 minutes. So this is what we have. This is our phase diagram for the moment, and so this is the model, no U, so no real correlations for the moment. This is the electron phonon coupling, which we define in this way. So if I take this self energy, calculate the mass renormalization because of this self energy diagram, I get m star over m equals 1 plus lambda, and that defines my dimensionless electron phonon coupling, g squared over 2k times 2 divided by w. So that is in the case of a flat band. And what we obtain here is the following for this quarter filled case: is that as a function of the phonon electron phonon coupling in the adiabatic limit, when the phonon frequency here is 0.1, we have a transition from a Luttinger liquid to a Luther-Emery liquid, which has dominant 2kF charge correlation. So this is a pyrrole phase, which we call. So it has one charge mode, and no, it has a spin gap. And then as a function of frequency, right, what we can do is to go from this phase, which is where the pairs are locked into a charge density wave. As a function of frequency, we can drive this phase into a superconducting state where we still have no charge. You have one charge mode, and you still keep the spin gap. Of course, this is all 1D physics, so these are all power laws. When I say Pyrrho's phase here, that means that the dominant correlation is a 2kF charge correlations. Here, there is a dominant correlation is the pairing correlations. And so this is the result. And let me show you how good the method is by really showing you some data. And we can basically do everything. Static, dynamical, if you use Maxent, spin and charge structure factors, we can do the optical conductivity, and we can also do single particle spectral functions. We've used a CDMFT to do those single particle spectral functions because you converge quicker. Okay, so so let me start with the results. These are the static properties for low frequencies as a function of the phonon frequency, as a function of the electron-phonon interaction. So this is the charge structure factor, just the Fourier transform of the charge-charge correlations here as a function of Q, right, from 0 to 2 pi. And let me show you how to read this. These are for very low lambdas, 0.15, you basically have this form, and you have essentially two cusps. You have one cusp at Q equals 0, it goes like this, which in 1D tells you that you have a power law decay of the charge-charge correlations with a modulation Q equals 0, right? So this is this cusp here, and this cusp at 2kF essentially tells you that you have a 2kF a power law decay of the charge correlations with, if U goes to 0, this K rho is equal to 1, and this gives me an R squared. So what you see out of this is that once you go to larger values of lambda, you develop up a large 2kF response. So you have a charge, a 2kF charge density wave. Here, you still have this cusp at Q equals zero. So you're staying in a metallic state, I would say. And what you get also is a very subdominant 4kF correlations. So you develop those 2kF charge correlations more or less at lambda equals 0.35. So we can go on and look at pairing. For the same set of parameters. And so this is pairing here, S-wave pairing, for a as a function of distance. And this is the same result, but on the semi-log plot. So what you should read out of this is that locally, this pair correlation function grows, which is telling me that two electrons tend to bind, right? And I will call this bipolaron. So they're binding into bipolarons. If you look at the long range of this pair correlation functions, these are the small lambdas here, and these are the large lambdas here. This decreases more or less like an order of magnitude, and this is telling me that the bipolarons are sort of getting localized, so they're getting stuck into a charge density wave, and they don't want to. They're not going superconducting. Okay, and we can look at the spin degrees of freedom. The spin degrees of freedom are for those small values of lambda. I still see those cusps here at 2kF and also at k equals 0, which is telling us that the spin-spin correlations are power law. If you go to the large value of lambda, 0.35, this seems to go much smoother, also at k equals 0 and at 2kF, telling you that you're developing a spin gap. Okay, so what we have here is a transition from a Luttinger liquid with a single charge, gapless charge mode and a gapless spin mode, and a Pyrrhus phase, which I argued is a gapless charge mode and a gap full spin mode. Okay, so we can confirm this with before going on, let me show you another set of data, which is aimed at going from this charge density wave phase where the pairs are localized in a 2kF pattern. If we increase the frequency, we can show that they can become mobile and generate a superconducting.
Short question.
Yes, please.
How about commutation? We 2kF is away from any lattice vector, I guess. So I would expect for your first strong
correlation. It's quarter filling. So the question is if it's going insulating or
yeah.
No, you need a for the quarter filling you need a So you need bigger longer range interactions to go to. So it can still stay a metal. It's not the half filled case. Where we go. So as a function of frequency, of phonon frequency, the point is that we can drive this charge density wave to a superconducting state. So these are a set of data. I'm fixing the lambda to 0.35, varying the frequency. And you'll see that this is the low frequency I was showing you to you before. When the frequency rises, this 2kF goes down and sort of stays here, and it fills up at other point. So the 2kF pairing charge correlations sort of become less dominant. And at the same time, these are the pairing correlations. So these are charge correlations. Sorry, the pairing correlations here. If you go from omega 0.1 to 4, you have a dramatic increase in the pairing correlations at omega equals 0 to 4. This is definitely the dominant correlation. Okay, so we can drive, if you want, this charge density wave to a superconducting state.
Lambda equals 1 or 2.
I'll show you why not. The method then becomes really very, very poorly. We have long order correlation times, and I'll tell you why. Why?
Can you read a Pavlov from this correlation?
We should do more simulations. Right, but in principle, you can read out of this. You should be able to read a power law and get the K rho. But we have to do a systematic scaling. This is not. These are just one-shot simulations. One can do more.
Jay? I was going to say it would be the same. If you can get the power law, you get K rho.
Sure.
And then you can predict when it will go from the charge density wave to the superconducting.
Yeah. So K rho bigger than 1 would give you the superconducting point. We're not as far. We did this for. Yes, getting K rho out of correlation functions, it may be tricky because of log corrections. So you can go wrong. So you have to be careful at how you do it. I think that's an important point. So we have
to read the lower figure. So there's these little steps. And I guess they relate to the charge density wave theory.
Yeah, this is a 2kF also.
Yeah. But forget the power law, I'll guess them out to be 5.
Yeah, you would have, well, the K-row for the, I think the pairing correlation should have there's a modulation 2KF, but the dominant one is the one which is with no modulation. Right, so, but you should have to take, so of course we can. So the spin, degrees of freedom remain around as a function of the frequency omega. The spin degrees of freedom remain gapped, and this you can read off these pairing static spin-spin correlation functions. This S of Q remains very a very smooth function. Okay, so this is the information we can get from the static quantities, namely from this spiral space. We can go from this spiral space to a superconducting phase. It's still not very precise how we should, in principle, as Jay say, calculate a K rho and see exactly when K rho goes beyond one and get the result out of this. So, but let me go on and show you some dynamics, some spin and charge dynamics along this line, because this is also what we can get out very nicely from the simulation. So this is the charge structure factor as a function for a lambda 0.35 and as a function of frequency. Right? So the starting point will be the non-interacting case where you have this particle hole continuum. So this is Q equals 0. This is pi over 2 for quarter filling is 2kF here. So you have these gapless charge excitation at Q equals 0 and 2kF. And what happens to this when you put on turn on the electron phonon coupling? This is in the pyrrole space, right? And so what I would like to see here is that you still have this charge, particle hole continuum, which is up here. But on top of this, you have a very piling up of spectral weight along, especially at pi at 2kF, but along all the Q vectors. And what would be nice, what I would like to see out of this is a very low, this is basically the charge dynamics of those bipolaron of this charge density wave, and with an extremely small velocity. And the problem is now you can see that you have extremely slow modes. And to answer your question, if we go to larger values of lambdas, these modes are going to go even slower, and it's extremely hard to control with the Monte Carlo, right? So you get stuck. That's the problem.
Okay.
For small frequencies and large lambda, it's very hard. If you go to larger frequencies and large lambdas, that may be okay.
Of course, that's probably physical.
Yes. Yeah. So that's, I wanted to, yeah. So the dynamics become slow, and you notice that also in the Monte Carlo dynamics.
I guess you can read it as that when the photon frequencies get very small, that the photons impose a small h-bar on the electron system.
Right.
This is much worse than that, because this is as lambda goes up, it gets exponentially
small.
Yeah.
This is adiabatic versus anti-adiabatic limit. When the phonon frequency is very small, the phonon can act as a kind of potential which
exactly.
to the electrons,
which has a very low.
Then you can solve as if it was a static potential, and then sort of do the adiabatic limit. When omega is large, then you can integrate essentially the phonon, and it gives you a kind of instantaneous interaction, which
right.
is attractive, and you can treat it both.
So the limit.
That's when you get really slow dynamics. That's when you get Frank Condon factors.
Yeah, and then you get let's say an attractive instantaneous interaction on the system, and you can do the intermediate between the two.
Okay, so this is the slow dynamics, right? And so what we can do is go on with putting in the larger values of omega naught and drive the mobility of those bipolarons or those pairs a bit much higher. And you see that this feature here, which is which we can really not resolve within the maxent for larger frequencies here, becomes much more mobile and has this beautiful larger velocity and also a very large peak at 2kF. Okay, so this enhancement of charge velocity as a function of omega naught can also be seen in the optical conductivity, because those two objects are related. Basically, via the continuity equation, the real part of the optical conductivity is just related to the dynamical charge structure factor. If you have a velocity, if I take the charge structure dynamical charge structure factor to be this is the sum rule, which is basically just the equal time correlation charge correlation functions and a single mode with a given velocity, then if you plug this into this equation here, you get that the optical conductivity in the limit omega going to zero at least has a delta function, which is the weight of which grows with the charge velocity of the charge carriers, right? The charge velocities of the bipolaron. So this is calculated explicitly by calculating the current correlation functions. And what we have is that for small omega naught here, we have extremely small charge Drude weight here, which comes in from the very slow dynamics of the bipolarons. If you go to larger values of omega naught, you have a huge transfer of spectral weight from higher frequency to lower frequencies, and this just blows up and goes to very large data. So we can really control and see what happens to the optical conductivity when you go from
is also a way to extract K rho.
Yes. These are you're asking. I completely agree, but it's you're asking where is the Drude peak? Is this a delta function or this is fun? You brought it, so if I integrate here and this is the Drude peak, so it's, I think if you want to get K rho, it's possible, but I think the correlation, I can show you some results afterwards if you want.
I guess you can do this also at finite temperature.
This is finite temperature. This is beta 40.
They were on my left-hand side a long time ago, I was worrying about dissipation in these one-dimensional systems.
Yeah, but this...
This is the most integrable one.
Yes, so...
That's a very interesting issue, how that works.
So the question Jan is asking is, for integrable systems, you should have a Drude weight at finite temperature, a delta function at finite temperature.
Nonsense.
And it's a lot of people have tried to get this out of Monte Carlo methods, and it's extremely hard because you have to get zero frequency data at finite temperature. And so the only way of getting this is through a maxent, through an analytical continuation. You can't extrapolate Matsubara frequencies to zero to get a Drude weight because you're at finite temperature. So these are questions which I think are extremely hard to answer, but of course, very nice. So this is what happens to the spin along this line where the frequency goes up and we're from this Parles phase to the superconducting phase. And you see that there is this is the starting point, same for the charge without any interactions. And you're eating up spectral weight at low frequencies here and also here so that we can extract a spin gap, right? So this would confirm that we have a spin gap of the order of 0.2 T for this model. Okay, so this is the data, which at least the two particle data, which is consistent with this phase diagram from a Luttinger liquid to a Luther-Emery liquid, where here for small omega naught you have a dominant 2kF charge density wave, for large values of omega you have a dominant pairing correlations, and depending on the, I think I can stop here, but we can or go on depending on what Doug tells me, and we can confirm this with a single particle spectral function. So that's one nice aspect of the method, is that we can calculate the single particle spectral function both in here and in here in this phase as a function of temperature, and try to obtain Luttinger liquid properties of this low temperature Luttinger liquid properties of this spectral function here. And here we can really see the gap in the single particle excitations in this Luther-Emery.
Yes. You're being schematic here, not phase transitions, it's one dimensional.
Yeah.
The crossover from the Parles to the superconducting is occurring at maybe not a half, which is
yes, more or less. I think this is again the question to be more precise. We have to be a bit more precise for the K-rows, and we can try to fit this a bit better. This is the big change in omega in the pairing correlations happen between omega 0.1 and omega 0.5.
Yeah, that's right. Okay.
So this is the big step, and then after it just grows. So it seems that here you're very close to a K rho equals 1 or a bit bigger.
I guess there's an interesting issue about the range of electron-Fallon interaction. I'd rather go to a long range electron-Fallon interaction. I would expect that you get a transition at a much smaller omega naught.
A long range.
That means. Injection, for instance, I would just basically.
So a dispersive phonon mode, you're saying, long range in
that
space?
That's just this sort of standard wisdom that when you have these fairly big polyps,
right,
they behave in a much more intelligent way,
right,
and it's hosting very tiny polyps.
Right. So that you...
It does. No, it does relate to the range.
No.
Yes, see.
I won't say anything.
It's the same method, and you find that the self-trapping occurs at much larger levels.
The problem with polaron is just a weak coupling polaron.
No, it's about the range being the coupling strong, and polaron stays big. I can give you the literature. This calculator is the same method.
So 0.5, more or less. So spectral functions. Part of this work was also driven by experimentalist friends in Würzburg, and they were looking. They really want to see temperature dependence of spectral functions for example, TTF, TCNQ, where you have phonons and correlations. And so we're not there yet, but the nice thing is that we have the ability of accessing those properties. So these are the spectral functions as a function of temperature for this phase, where you have a small, so in the Luttinger liquid phase, and a very adiabatic phonons. So this is K, and this is the frequency. So they're sort of 90 degrees rotated to the standard way of plotting. So this is the cosine band.
Did you say whether the DMFT is coming in? Why is it not coming directly out of the Monte Carlo?
It is. You want to extrapolate to the thermodynamic limit, right? Is it better to extrapolate to the thermodynamic limit by doing CDMFT and making bigger and bigger and bigger sizes? Or is it better to stay really on the lattice size? Right, and it turns out that it's better. You get also nicer plots.
Okay, so but directly your Monte Carlo, except you put.
I put the CDMFT
condition with the cluster size.
Right. Exactly. Full, exactly. You get the self-consistent Born approximation for free here. Right. That's for example. Right, and then you put in the correlation. So it's just a nicer way of extrapolating, but we should extrapolate to larger cluster sizes. So yes. So this is the cosine band, high temperatures and very low temperatures. High temperatures bigger than the phonon frequency and much lower than the phonon frequency. So the high temperature case is very easy to understand. We just did a self-consistent Born approximation from this paper, right, Engelbach-Schrieffer. And these are the self-consistent Born approximation results, and this is the Monte Carlo with Maxent, with stochastic Maxent. And you have more or less the same very broad spectra when that's it. I think we can understand it this way. If you go to very low temperatures, of course, the vertex corrections come in, et cetera, and we would like to understand what we get from the spectral function from the point of view of bosonization. And so let me go through this very quickly. We will linearize around the Fermi point, so this will be the free electron here, and then write the electron-phonon interaction in terms of those left and right movers, and what you have is, of course, then many interactions. You have the backward scattering here, which we will neglect, and you also have, so this will go away in the Luttinger liquid fixed point, and also the forward scattering, we just retain this, and if you retain this, then you have a very simple model where you have the spin modes and the charge modes, and the charge modes couple here to the phonons. You can solve this, and you get with a Bugi-Lubov transformation, and you basically, what you obtain is three modes. The spin mode, which just goes through, doesn't couple to the phonons, so this would be this dashed line. And you have two charge mode, which couples. So you have the phonon mode, which would be just straight, like this, and you have the charge mode, which is like that. They couple, they open a hybridization gap, and they basically renormalize a bit the velocity here. So what we would expect is to see in the single particle spectral functions sort of peaks which go like this, and a peak which goes like that, and, well, also the spin. And, of course, this is very hard. We believe that if I blow this up, I believe that you can see this. This is KF. This is this sort of charge mode here. this part here, which we can pick up, and we have also this sort of dominant phonon mode, which we can pick up here, which is also on the other side at positive frequencies, not only at negative frequencies, but at positive frequencies. So the claim is that we can, we can interpret our data in terms of those Luttinger liquid calculations. I'm sorry, these were done by Volker Meden, Kurt Schoenhammer, and Hariguna-san some time ago. Okay, so and finally, we can also do this in the parallel space. We can track the temperature dependence of the single particle spectral function. And let me just draw your attention to those low temperature results here. So this is here, this is KF, right? And so you see that you have you're opening a gap here at KF, and this gap is more or less consistent with the spin gap. So this 2 times the quasi-particle gap, so that will be the distance, this is KF, so that will be this distance here, is more or less consistent with the spin gap of 0.2 T, which we obtained by measuring directly the dynamical spin correlation functions. Okay, so I'm done. I wanted to tell you that this it's a very nice and rather easy method to implement, which I think is rather powerful, especially if you want to integrate phonon degrees of freedom in models of correlated electron systems. There are a lot of things we're trying to do for the moment. We're trying to go to different type of phonons, to Zu3 for Heger phonons. We're trying to go to the true thing, which is phonons and correlations. We have quite a lot of preliminary results on what happens with phonons and heavy fermions, and this we haven't started yet, so this because it's much harder than I thought. TTF, TCNQ, the real combination of in one dimension of phonons and correlations, that's turns out to be hard. Thank you.
Parker has actually done what we've encouraged people to do, which is control the length of their talk so we have time for discussion. So now we better have discussion.
one model here that I could add on the list is the spin-pyrrhos transition, which in a way is right. A simpler version because it would be spinless fermions
right.
With the nearest neighbor interaction
right.
In presence of phonons.
Yes, I completely agree.
In connection with this model, we analyzed it by bosonization and used the variational method that worked very well to
right.
Get the transition and this transition between the adiabatic and the anti-adiabatic
okay.
Limit.
Yeah.
It would be, I think, very interesting to try to see if it works for the
okay.
Borstein model and,
okay.
And how it compares yeah. With the numerics, because this is specially engineered to deal with this retarded
right.
Interaction.
Right.
Now that you've shown us how easy it is, when are we going to have 2 and 3 dimensions?
Well, we have infinite dimensions.
Honey?
We have infinite dimensions. I'm not the kind of person to take things unkindly. this is a problem in every method, right?
Yeah.
Of course. And so the only answer is you can do DMFT, and then you can do clusters. So that's the aim. That's the only thing. And then clusters, putting in those phonons. We're talking with Mark to put in those phonons in the Hubbert model.
Is the sign right. Problem the same as the ordinary determinable quantum Monte Carlo?
Yes. The sign problem is behaves very similarly to the ordinary determinable. That's basically the nice thing of this mapping, if you want, from this weak coupling continuous time to the continuous time Hirsch-Phi, and the continuous time Hirsch-Phi is very similar to the determinable somehow.
And Blankenbeckler.
Yeah, exactly. The Blankenbeckler sugar and your method is basically the same sign as the Hirsch-Phi. It's the same method, principle, the same method, at least sign-wise. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm sort of thinking about the far future outlook, right? Is it still sort of playing out these models?
Right.
You might think that at a point you really have to turn to real world where
yeah.
There might be the detail, especially with phonons, etc.
Yeah.
I can imagine that, right, the hardship is really an electron system, there are the signs, but you have lots and lots of one-dimensional systems, right, where the electrons are pretty one-dimensional. Can you dream about sort of, you know, bringing this to the level of sort of first principle calculation where it merges LDA, take into account three-dimensional phonons, blah, 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 and get at the point where Gaudi Cotterill would like to be in higher dimensions, but now in a way that's more controlled because you live from one dimension.
Wow.
Just dreaming, you know?
I can dream. I don't know if I, yeah, so. So what's, I mean, I think, so I don't really know how to answer this. My dream is to, if you want to say, you know, it's more to stay in the, I think there are many questions in the in the model world of what happens to phonons and correlations. I think that's the first step. I mean, I think the questions of going to finite dimensions and to really look at phonons, interplay of phonons and correlations.
Like really, you know, you can be anywhere you wish in one dimension there.
Yes.
And then it's like in higher dimensions, okay, you pull these headaches, but in one dimension it's the way.
Okay, so now I understand the question.
And then you can ask the question, what is the next step? Doing more variations on these one-dimensional models? I can hear
okay, so variations. So now I understand the question a bit more. The TTFTC and Q materials are one-dimensional materials. They're coupled chains, right? They turn out to, they're very nice photoemission experiments on those materials, which go down to 60K. At 60K, you have a Parallels transition, right? At least something like this. So all the results which are the photoemission results for this materials are analyzed on the basis of a single band Hubbard model without even taking longer range interactions. And I think this is one application where we would like to go and really try to model, if you want, those photoemission experiments. So we need phonons and correlations. And this would be done. So that we would like to do. This is hard because the correlations are large. These are large correlations. The U was estimated to be 5, something like this. And so it's a weak coupling method. So you have phonons plus strong correlations, and you need temperature dependence of spectral function. So this would be one very clear cut application of the method. But I think we need more. We have to learn how to.
No, that would really be nice.
Yeah, but it's.
Parker, let me follow that up with what I think you alluded to with heavy fermions. What can you really tell us about, say, pulsing and the effect of turning on U, or if I take perhaps what you haven't done, and your neighbor like phonon coupling
right.
of some kind? What do we know from what we've done about what U is going to do to what we think phonons do?
Okay, so
do you have runs on?
No, we just have runs on heavy fermions, and the question we wanted to address here is if you start off with a heavy fermion system, then the Fermi energy is basically the coherence temperature, and it's extremely small. So the phonon frequencies are bound to be much higher than this. And the question was, what happens to the coherence temperatures of those heavy fermions as a function if you turn on the electron phonon interactions? And it turns out that the whole heavy fermion state breaks down very quickly if you put in phonon degrees of freedom on the conduction electron. So these are the things. So the background is, I mean, if you don't have a Migdal theorem, what happens? I think that was the first type of question we're trying to ask, and the heavy fermion case was a nice candidate for us.
I just realized that I'm completely confused about your basic figure here.
Good. Yeah.
So. At omega naught equals
0.1. This is very schematic.
Yeah, but yeah. At omega naught equals 0,
yeah, this
I
is,
know the phase diagram.
Yeah, this should go to 0.
Spin gap phase for all lambda.
Right, right.
So there's no lambda c on that.
So for omega equals 0, you're just classical phonons, right?
Right.
And then you would have you have the Parallels instability, and you get a gap which is exponentially small. So it's in the sense of singularity in the gap. When you put in quantum phonons, it's not so clear.
No, I understand, but there could be a critical value of lambda at finite omega naught.
Right. So this
I actually
this,
think that probably. No, I don't know, but that can be. But on the omega naught equals 0 axis,
right.
There can't be a critical lambda.
There cannot. Yes, I completely agree. So this plot here is very. It does not start at 0. Right? The 0 would be here, and this lambda would go here. Okay. So this is just a cut, you know, very schematic. We just set a set of runs at omega naught equals 0.1 as a function of lambda, and then as a function of omega. But
well,
clearly, this will.
I understand this.
Yeah.
This is what you said. You're saying that
land to sea is moving as a function?
Well, it has to. It has to, because if I
understand. So you're saying if you come down, that point moves over.
It has to, because we know what's
right.
We know.
Yeah. I just want to make sure.
Yeah. It has to do this.
Okay. Now, sorry about this.
Okay.
About this at the time, but I'm still confused now. So now if omega naught goes to infinity,
yeah,
then this becomes the
attractive view
exactly. Hubbard model.
Right.
And I thought that for the attractive view Hubbard model, you're always in a Luther-Emery phase.
No, but he has also repulsive.
Well, you have a repulsive interaction.
No, there's no repulsive interaction here. So it should go back like this.
Wow. Okay.
Right, that's the point. Because correct. If you go to omega naught going to infinity, you have the attractive view.
Yeah.
You're always in this phase.
Right. But what's got a little complicated, I think, is since lambda scales as you have to be increasing your couple with g.
Right. So g squared over
right.
Yeah. Right. No, but lambda. You can change the mass of the phonon just changing. Then you would change lambda without changing the frequency.
Right.
That's in principle. You can. These two parameters are in principle independent. And the notation I have, these two parameters are independent of each other. So yes, the correct phase diagram is something. This lambda c would go like this and should go back to. That's what you would expect from limiting cases.
Yeah. So I just had one other comment. That this problem that Doug brought up of the combined electron-phonon and electron-electron interaction has at least been solved in weak coupling. And
yes.
Very interesting interplays. You can get, for instance, enhancement of the electron-phonon coupling
right.
By interaction effects.
Who's it?
What?
So can you method treat the optically active phonons which coupled with long range electromagnetic field?
Can I treat optical phonons?
Optically active
phonon. In principle, yes.
So you can handle long range electromagnetic interactions.
Let me think of it and after answer the question. I don't want to say yes and it's no, right?
One question that always seemed to come up was about the Coulomb pseudopotential. Somehow
right.
Static interaction in Coulomb gets reduced because you have the reduction
right.
of the energy signals of negative I compared to T Fermi. Have you thought of looking at that at all? Simply to see that what we know very well happens in lead, you can actually pick up.
No, we haven't done that yet, but we can do. We can certainly try to do it.
And maybe what Steve asked, continuing the question, somehow up here, once you go superconducting, it would seem like. You know if you let omega go high enough so you have negative U.
Yeah.
You then crank up the coupling enough, we know that QD, TC comes down.
Correct.
Or
right.
Cost of the
right.
Down.
Right.
Have you done any?
Temperature.
Any work to try and understand the fact that the failure of Ulyashvili.
No. This is on the.
TC should go as the square root of lambda, and we know eventually it comes down.
No, this could be done. This has there are a set of points of things, but this definitely could be tried. Sorry, yeah, no.
Thank you for giving us a chance.
We'll straight off now.